Anyhow.
I'm Locke Oaks. There's some of you. Okay.
Good for you.
Yeah, take the stairs. Good for you. Absolutely. I saw somebody come in. I had something, and I ended up beating him up the stairs. I'll work on that. The old man is going faster than you. All right. What I'm going to do is give you a brief introduction to some general ideas about addiction. That includes some information on how the brain works. I don't know if any of you, did anybody sneak away real quick to a computer and print the thing that's in, okay, you do, a few of you got it. What you're about to see, you have in its entirety online. I posted it before class, actually. So you have all the details for the PowerPoint you're about to see. So the only notes you really need to take as we go here are any sort of examples or additional information that I bring up that's not on the PowerPoint. Again, I'm not trying to scare you off, but some of the information is kind of technical because it really does. It has to do with how your brain works. Drugs behavior, this picture is just from an old documentary called Faces of Meth. Some drugs really do a number on that. The influence of time. Old ads. Before you scold me, Mom, maybe you better light up a Marlboro.
Really?
And what's to scold? The kids are... ads are funny. But in the old days, gee, Dad, you always get the best of everything, even Marlboro. Great, that's nice. Once upon a time, right? Once upon a time. This is not Photoshop. This is not made up. This is real. There was an old ad. Just like this. This is it. You can actually go on, if you're curious about it, go online, look up Lloyd Manufacturing Company and put in something about history or something like that, and it'll come up. Absolutely true. the things that they used to use for cure. Yeah, absolutely. The trace up, yes. So what I want to talk to you about in the last little bit here is the idea of addiction. If you are really interested in this area, MCTC has an addiction counseling program where you can learn to be an addiction counselor. Good program, lots of great information. If you're interested, check it out. So I'm just going to give you some highlights here. Number one, substance, any substance, abuse. Is usually defined as using a lot of the substance despite problems that use causes. So people use a great deal of a substance, that use causes problems, but they continue to use. And the problems that they experience are across different areas of their life. So at work, at home, at school, in the community, use causes addiction, this is characterized by a number of different qualities. Number one, the sense of an obsession with getting your hands on the substance. So this way of thinking that says, I gotta get it, that comes with a behavioral desire to use the substance. Attempts to cut back fail. So people will say that they're gonna try and stop, and then they go right back to it. And this really, so we've got the behavior, the compulsive desire, and you know, you try to stop but you can't. Then the second thing here is tolerance. And this is true in some cases with social drinking, but overall, people who have trouble with addiction, they start off with a small amount. So they'll use a small amount of a substance, but they get used to it, so it doesn't give them much of an effect. So they use more of the substance to get the feeling back. Then they get used to that amount, so they need more of the drug. That increasing, or that pattern of increasing the amount that you need in order to get an effect, is called tolerance. So basically you need more of the drug to get the same effect. The goofy example I give, there are teenagers who can pretty much, because they don't drink, they can pretty much sniff a beer cap and get hammered. Then they actually need to taste a little bit of it. Then they actually have to finish one whole thing to get the feeling. Then they have to do two. Then they have to do three. Then they have to do six. Right? And it increases until they're drinking half a case to get that same sort of buzz. If you need a half a case to get a buzz, you're either incredibly large or you have a problem.
Just a question for you. I don't even cover you on the side. And I, with me, it's like, I can't really say the tolerance is high. But when I was drinking, I would just have a little bit, and I would come back to the blind back. But you have the tolerance.
In that specific case, the short answer to that question is I'm not sure. I would have to investigate a little bit. If there are folks who indeed consume consistently and a lot and have trouble with it, but never really develop the tolerance, what might do that? Is there a medication? Is there a genetic thing? Is there a biological thing? But I'd have to investigate. I don't know.
I think it's just with chronic alcoholism where it's like it's in your system so much that just a little bit you would have.
And that could be the case, sure. I'd have to do a little more reading. Dependency, substance dependency, tolerance is part of that. The idea that you try to stop but can't, that's part of dependency. Withdrawal, where a person who consumes a substance and then they stop for a little bit, they get the feeling like they're going to be sick. They get shaky and headachy and sick to their stomach. And in order to get rid of those feelings, they consume more of the substance. The thing that's important as far as our purposes tonight, dependency can be physical or psychological or both. So we're talking dependency, we're basically talking about addiction. It can be physical, it can be psychological, it can be both. There are some folks out there who believe, well, you started, you can just stop. Sometimes, no, you can't. There are drugs that are physically addicting, and you can't just stop. And I'll give you some examples of that sort of physical addiction. Much of addiction is psychological. Just to make the differentiation here for you, something like heroin. Heroin is one of those really heavy-duty, nasty drugs that can create a physical reliance on it. I got to give you a little idea of how the brain works. How many people here know the name of the stuff that's in your brain naturally, it belongs there, that we call your body's natural painkillers?
Dopamine? No, endorphins.
I'm not sure if I heard it. Endorphins. If you said endorphins, you got it. Endorphins. Your brain will produce them. That's what they did. It's normal. It's supposed to happen. If you add heroin, your brain is going to realize that heroin and endorphins act in a very similar way. So now let's say with some consistency you're adding heroin. Your brain starts to say, you know what? I got an awful lot of this endorphin-like stuff kicking around. I don't need to make as much endorphin. There's an abundance of this stuff. So it starts scaling back its production of endorphins. So it starts slowing down the production of what it should be producing because you keep adding this endorphin-like stuff from the outside. If you continue along that path, it gets to a point where your brain essentially starts shutting down the production of endorphins. So now when you try and, let's just say, cut back on the heroin, guess what happens? Now your system is without endorphins, and now it starts to run low on the heroin. And your system says, holy shit, where'd it all go? And you start getting this urge. You start getting this feeling. And it's a really overwhelming one. Like, I got to reset the balance. I got to increase the level of this stuff in my brain. Your brain doesn't just magically go, oh shit, crank out the endorphins. Can't. Doesn't work that way. So what does the person do? Abavain. Restores the balance. Heroin alters your brain chemistry. That is a physical reality. Can drugs be physically addicting? Absolutely. The stronger, more potent ones like heroin and meth and that sort, it messes significantly with your brain chemistry. It alters it. That can mess you up for long periods of time. Do you know how they help people kick the heroin habit?
Yeah, they give them that juice stuff.
Methadone. Oh my god, isn't that a drug? Like, let's say, well, like methadone or something?
Methadone. Mm-hmm. Methadone is medically or synthetic. It's medically sanctioned heroin. It's sorry?
I was just saying it's kind of BS that they do that because they do, like, I don't know. I worked at a homeless shelter, and so many people would do that. And
right.
They got addicted to that.
Oh, absolutely. If it's not supervised and done properly, absolutely. That's one of the problems. Really, all they're doing at a methadone clinic is weaning you off. They put the synthetic stuff in that acts just like heroin, and they slowly start to taper you off, giving your system a chance to kind of reset itself and the endorphin thing to start working and ease you out of it. They're just weaning you. Why do you think methadone clinics get robbed? Right? Methadone has value. You know why? It's like heroin. So, yeah, you can get it. It's not that you get addicted. You're staying addicted to similar stuff. It's got to be done right, yeah. But the physical thing, methamphetamine, I'll tell you actually what it does in a minute here. Psychological addiction. Anybody who ever says, well, I need to have a few drinks to be more social, that's psychological. You think you need it. You don't. There is no requirement there. You could go and learn some social skills and get better at saying, hi, I'm so-and-so, nice to meet you, can I buy a drink? You know, that's alcohol is not some magic there. So that feeling like, or, oh, you know, I'm really stressed out, I got to have a cigarette. No, you don't. Right? It's that thinking. That is very much the psychological aspect of addiction. And oftentimes both are at play. When somebody tries to stop using a substance, they may go through this withdrawal stuff. Sometimes, depending on the nature of the drug, the withdrawal symptoms can be fatal. In the case of something like heroin or very significant alcohol kind of addiction, withdrawal, just saying, okay, screw it, I'm cutting it cold turkey, you can die. So, yeah, pretty nasty. And that's where you really start to see that compulsive desire coming, because as the drug starts to fade away and you know, its effects aren't felt, the desire to get it becomes incredibly strong. We're not, okay, I'm just going to motor us past this, you don't need, okay, anyway. There's a joke in there, another time. Here's where things get a little heavy on the brain anatomy and physiology. Don't run screaming scared from the room. Got to give you just a bit of a background on how the brain works. You have about 100 billion, with a B, that's great, neurons. Those are the main communication cells in your central nervous system. So in your brain, you got lots and lots of neurons. These neurons communicate with one another with electrical and chemical signals. The chemical part of that signal is done with these neurotransmitters. There are other things, but neurotransmitters are the main chemical messengers in your brain. The neurons, these 100 billion cells, at the point where one communicates with another, they don't actually touch. There's a little tiny space between them. And these chemical messengers, these neurotransmitters, have to float across that space. Now, this is a pretty lame picture for you, but imagine that if I'm a cell sending a signal, and you're a cell that's going to receive the signal, I have to release these neurotransmitters. And essentially, they come over to your cell and knock on the door and say, hey, there's information here, send it along. Okay, so these chemical messengers. Some drugs will get into that chemical messaging system and mess with it. There are two common ways that they can mess with neurotransmitters. Drugs sometimes will act like the neurotransmitters. They mimic the neurotransmitters. They're like imposters. We call those imposters, call those drugs, agonists. I'll give you an example of an agonist in a little bit. An antagonist is a drug that gets in with these neurotransmitters and gets in the way of the neurotransmitters. They block the neurotransmitters. Any of you live in like an apartment with assigned parking? Mm-hmm. Or you go, if someone was in your parking spot, you can't park your car there, now can't you? Well, if a drug is in the way like that of a neurotransmitter, a neurotransmitter can't do its job. Another, do any of you have a key on your key ring that maybe fits in the lock for home or someplace, but it won't turn it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Same idea as an antagonist. It fits the lock, but it doesn't do anything. So until you pull that key out that's wrong, the real key can't work. Right? That's what some drugs do. They block neurotransmitters. Now, to facilitate things, I'll show you a picture of what I'm talking about. Special part of the neuron sending the signal called the axon, the terminal button. This cell here is sending information. This cell down here is receiving information. These little yellow things, those are the neurotransmitters. Those are the chemical messengers. I'm going to give you an example to just show you that some of the terms we use, there's a reason for them, and they actually do make sense. How many of you have ever heard the term SSRI? The acronym SSRI, what is that? Don't tell me what it stands for in general. What are they? What are SSRIs?
They are antidepressants.
Antidepressant medications. If you've ever heard of Prozac,
oh, yeah,
or Zoloft, those are two examples of SSRI medications. Selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Don't try and write it down. Selective, meaning it chooses one thing. Serotonin, that is the neurotransmitter that this particular drug selects. Okay, so selective serotonin. So now all these little yellow dots, let's pretend those are serotonin neurotransmitter molecules. Reuptake. Reuptake in the brain is essentially recycling. This cell releases, in this case, serotonin. It releases it so it can go do its job and tell this cell, hey, send the message. But if the serotonin lingers here in this space too long, this cell just takes it back up, repackages it, and uses it again later. It recycles. That recycling process is called reuptake. There it is. Take it back up. Inhibitor, stop. Inhibit means stop. So if we can stop the recycling, that means the serotonin's going to hang out here in this space longer, which means it can have longer time to do its job. That's what antidepressants of the SSRI variety do. It allows this cell to release the serotonin into this space, and then it stops the recycling process so the serotonin stays in this space longer, gives it more chance to do its job. Selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor tells you exactly the mechanism by which they work in the brain. Well, what would happen if we introduced a drug that acted like serotonin? What if we introduced a drug that blocked serotonin? Okay. A lot of drugs, whether they're prescribed or whether they're naughty, get in there and mess with this system. I'm going to tell you about another neurotransmitter. It is called GABA. GABA, don't write this down, gamma-aminobutyric acid. It is a neurotransmitter. Imagine that your 100 billion neurons, each one of those 100 billion can make up to 10,000 other connections with other neurons. Anybody real quick with the math? What's 100 billion times 10,000? A whole bloody lot. Okay, good. At a third of all those connection points, you have this stuff. This stuff is essential. What does it do? It slows things down. Essentially, what GABA lets you do is tune things out. Imagine, look around this room right now. It's actually quite a dull room.
You wish they'd paint different colors places.
Horribly bland. But now imagine this. Imagine if your senses, your eyes, your ears, you know, all that, if your senses had to pay attention to every detail that is present in here. Light, contour, contrast, corners, all that stuff, sounds. How many of you can hear, right over here, can you hear the fan on there?
I can.
Okay. Can you hear the fan on the computer up here and the stuff over there? Can you feel the heat coming off of it? Right. What about temperature? Have you felt that over the course of the class it's gotten warmer in here?
Yeah.
Have you known? How's the person next to you smell? I don't want to know. Every little sound, every scent, every sight, everything. Imagine if you had to pay equal attention to all of it. You would be stark, raving mad. Completely insane. You would be on information overload instantly. It would be hugely overwhelming. GABA allows you to tune pretty much everything up so that you can selectively attend to things. Right? Big time import. Right? Gotta have this. Alcohol acts just like GABA. Which means alcohol is a GABA agonist. Mimics. GABA is inhibitory. It slows things down. Alcohol, much like GABA, slows things down. By adding a bunch of alcohol, you're adding a bunch of stuff that acts like GABA. It just slows things down even more. So that sense of right and wrong gets slowed down. The judgment, the planning, the rate, it gets slowed down. Alcohol's a GABA agonist. Some anti-anxiety meds are GABA agonists. In some cases where there's high anxiety, we need to slow things down a little bit more. So some anti-anxiety meds, some anxiolytics, are GABA agonists. Here comes the neuroanatomy, the parts of the brain that I got to tell you a little bit about. Your brain, go figure, has basically a pleasure and reward circuitry. Sorry, do we need the doors closed for noise?
Might help.
Okay. Sorry, I was for heat and circulation, I was leaving. Okay. I apologize on behalf of noisy people. A couple areas in your brain, one is called the nucleus accumbens, another one is called the ventral tegmental area. These are two key parts of the brain that have to do with your sense of pleasure and reward. Now, you don't need naughty, bad drugs to stimulate these areas of the brain. Food, anything that meets a basic need, and then things like sex, they stimulate these parts of the brain. So normal stuff that you enjoy. I mean, if you really enjoy roller coasters or going on vacation, this part of the brain will be more active. Because it feels good. Well, a lot of drugs mess with this area of the brain. A lot. I told you I'd give you an example of meth. Methamphetamine increases the amount of dopamine, neurotransmitter, in this part of the brain 12 times. Hugely addictive. Okay. So it's not just GABA that drugs mess with. Drugs can mess with all sorts of things. Endorphins, GABA, glutamate, anandamide, dopamine, serotonin. I mean, they can mess with all sorts of things. In this case, cocaine and meth increase dopamine big time. With meth, 12 times in the area of the nucleus accumbens. Big time physical addiction.
Well, like,
people who smoke crack, they don't eat.
Well, some of the drugs have the side effect of suppressing appetite. Other drugs give you the munchies. They mess with these areas of the brain differential.
So because Adderall and methamphetamine, would that be bad for me?
No.
Kind of got the same.
Nope. Nope. Adderall in cases of ADHD does exactly what it's supposed to do. It stimulates things like attention. But it also stimulates this area. So while you're paying attention and you're tuning things out that you shouldn't be paying attention to, you also feel good. Things like Ritalin, I'm not going off on this tangent very far, so just hear this. Things like Ritalin, people go, oh my God, it's dangerous, it's addictive. If you take it as prescribed, no, it is not. If you crush it up and snort it, it can kill you. But that's speed. Okay, that's why it has street value.
They do that with Adderall too.
Yeah, they do. And that is where people can complain that, hey, this shit's addictive. If you take it as prescribed, it is safe and it is not habit forming. If you crush it up and snort it, that's poor man's speed. And it's very dangerous. So when you hear objections to, oh my God, Ritalin's dangerous, if you don't take it properly, it certainly can do it. But yeah, it's amphetamine. Here's a picture. Let me describe this. This is lovely. Okay, so some of you may know this. I hope you don't. Let's just pretend we're going to crack my skull. We're going to cut my skull this way. So around the nose and straight back. We're going to peel away the left half. And what's left is you looking at the inside part of the remaining right half. That's what you're looking at here. Cut this in half. Peel the left side away, you're looking in at the right half of my brain. When you do that, you expose all this stuff in the middle. Here's the cortex, this is the part that makes us human. It makes us the top of the food chain. Here's the frontal lobe, where all your reasoning and judgment, planning and decision making is going on. In the middle area here, things like the nucleus accumbens, it sits down in here, and the amygdala, your book talks about the amygdala when you're reading about emotions. There it is. Ventral tegmental area that we're talking about here is part of this pleasure circuitry. It's back here. Your hypothalamus, right in the middle here. The hypothalamus, just so you know, it has a lot to do with our motivated behavior. And the hypothalamus has a lot to do with what psychology people call the four Fs of behavior. The four Fs, fighting. Fleeing, as in running away. So you got the fight or flight response, two of the Fs. Feeding. Hypothalamus governs a lot to do with our eating behavior. And the fourth F. I didn't make up the joke. There is a clean F word. Fornicating.
That's still not clean.
One of these semesters, the wrong thing is going to come flying out of my mouth. Okay, so, but all of this in terms of addiction, right? Your judgment, your sense of pleasure and reward, your sense of motivation, your emotions, right? It's all in the circuitry. Drugs mess with that. Alcohol. Mentioned it before. I mentioned that sort of trickle-down idea. It depresses. Alcohol is a depressant. It slows down brain activity. It slows down your judgment, your reasoning, and your planning, and your inhibition. A lot of people think, like I mentioned before, that it's a stimulant because it makes you seem more outgoing. That's only because it's reducing your sense of inhibition. It's not actually stimulating anything. So what does it do? I know it's not stimulating things. It means it's not making you more of anything. But what it does is it connects with the GABA receptors. And when it does that, it has the same effect as GABA, which is to slow things down.
if it gets deep enough into the brain, you consume enough alcohol, yeah, it can depress vital functions, which means you die. This is sort of that trickle-down thing that I was telling you about, first of all. It affects your forebrain. So the frontal lobe slows things down like judgment or anything in planning. Second thing, it gets into the middle, starts messing with things like your emotions. Third, it starts messing with more important vital functions. Yeah. Okay, you get the idea. There's a baseball. All right. Last but not least, marijuana.
Hallucinogen.
Marijuana is a hallucinogen. Different category of drugs. This is not a house, so we're not going to get into all the whys and wherefores of every drug. The moral of this story is that your brain, naturally, right here, right now, is wired to receive marijuana. No, I'm not suggesting you run out and buy some. No. But there is a chemical in your brain called anandamide. The active ingredient in marijuana is chemically very, very similar to anandamide. They're pretty much the same thing. So your brain's already set up for it. The active ingredient in marijuana is called THC for short, called tetrahydrocannabinol. It's absorbed very rapidly, so people feel the effects quickly. Depending on the user, you get very different effects. Some people think it's great and wonderful and fun and funny and yee-haw, and other people get paranoid and kind of wigged out. Depends. It is called a gateway drug. It is not the only gateway drug. Alcohol is a gateway drug. A gateway drug is a drug that you kind of start with. Most people don't just walk up and start doing cocaine and heroin. They usually start smaller. They start with things like alcohol. They start with things like marijuana. If people are looking for a bigger high than those can give, they get bored with these lighter drugs and they try harder things. So usually this sort of opens the door to potential harder drug use.
Yeah, I just want to say I understand what you're saying about all these drugs and stuff.
Yep.
I just want to say that, you know, if you're bruised anything, it can kill you. I just know heroin, I mean cocaine. If you're bruised anything, it's wrong.
Yeah. There are definitely drugs, you're right. There are definitely drugs that if you use them over the long haul, they definitely can do really bad things to you. If you abuse something like caffeine, the probability that it's going to kill you is slim to none. But it will raise your blood pressure. It will screw up your sleep. It can do things that will physically mess with you, yes. When we talk about any of these harder type drugs, yeah, if you mess with them too much, they'll put you on the other side of the dirt.
Yeah, Ron, cocaine, I'm
eating
it all.
We don't want to know. Not right now. I told you already that your brain has this stuff that makes it receptive to THC. I guess that's called anandamide. You have these receptors that are pretty much ready to go. It's interesting to see where these receptors in the brain are. So when you look, hippocampus, right? People who use marijuana a lot will tell you that it messes with what the hippocampus does. Memory. Your cerebral cortex. Things like your judgment, your reasoning, your planning, all that stuff. But perception as well. The limbic system. That includes things like the amygdala. So it messes with emotion. Cerebellum has to do with coordination. It also has to do with motor memory. And the basal ganglia has a lot to do with our motor activity. So it messes with all sorts of things like your mood and your emotion, your appetite. It messes things up. Some people talk about using it to treat chronic pain. I am no expert in the area of the medicinal use of marijuana, nor do I have any particular opinion on it, because I'm uneducated about it. There are studies, however, that show that for people with terminal illnesses that are in a ton of pain, that smoking marijuana sometimes alleviates their pain. Other people refute that claim and say it's a bunch of crap. It's just information that's out there if you want to pursue it, knock yourselves up. I'm saying I don't know tons about marijuana and chronic pain in that relationship.
So just like heroin, how it makes endorphins, and just like this one makes the stuff that makes my brain fun.
That's what I don't know.
You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying?
Sorry, keep going.
Could, like, our bodies can get addicted to heroin and eventually kill our bodies? So could it do the same for it? Could our body get an overload of?
No.
The probability of ODing on THC is minimal. It's not something, however, the thing over time that marijuana use will do, it will cook your lungs a lot faster because it's not filtered. You're sucking fire. So in terms of what's happening in your lungs, bad. In terms of ODing on it or something like that, not so much. But. Addiction, you know, people debate this a lot with marijuana. Compared to other substances, it is less likely to cause a physical addiction, but it can be very psychologically addictive. Now, people debate that point. But overall, the consensus is that marijuana is not something that's going to cause physical addiction. It's not going to cause inalterable changes in your brain chemistry, but people come to rely on it and they think that they need it and want it.
So, what if you cook it?
I don't know. That's a giant deal. I am definitely no marijuana expert. And on that happy note, I didn't inhale. I'm lying. I could run for office, and we'll see you around. If you didn't hand in your assignment already, please leave it in the file.
Oh, we're done.
What if you cook it? I have no idea what happens if you cook it.